All right, everybody, welcome back to this second episode. Well, yeah, second episode of Unidentified History, not an unidentified history. We kind of dropped the and part and just went with unidentified history. But we are actually going to get to the historical stuff on this episode. Should be a good one. Should be a good one. I think we have gotten all the sexual innuendo and banter out of our way before we actually started recording. Although DJ's looking like he might have some more to look at that grin. Look at that grin. That is, okay, DJ, for the people listening, what are you drinking? Because it looks like, I don't know what it looks like.
It's a baby mason jar of some hazelnut moonshine.
Ooh. All right. Hazelnut moonshine. That sounds like a good time. You've heard
it. You're supposed to mix it with shit, but I don't play around with that.
Yeah, like that. What was it? That last episode of Big Five where Rob was just drinking Jack straight from the bottle until it was gone to get through King of the Ring 95. Yeah, that was.
Yes.
So you're taking
that
a
was
more.
Great.
You are taking a more nuanced approach, I see, to the alcohol tonight.
I am. Yeah, I'm out of regular whiskey, and I'm trying to start working out again. So I'm trying to cut back a little bit on some things, and alcohol is one of the first things I got to cut back on. Alcohol and sweets.
But one thing that you do have is still the greatest beard in all of podcasting, whether it's wrestling, whether it's UFOs, whether it's anything. It is the greatest beard in podcasting, award-winning beard. I should let you guys know, for you folks in the UAP community who may not know, yeah, DJ's got the greatest beard in podcasting. So I've put you over, so why don't you introduce yourself to the folks here, Deej? How are you doing, man?
I'm good, man. It's been a long week. The last 5 days have lasted about 9.5, so I'm ready to unwind for the weekend and talk some stuff with you guys, have some fun here, maybe unpack some stuff.
Yeah, we're going to unpack some stuff. We are also, of course, joined by our partner in crime, our comrade in arms, the world's biggest lover of all things wind chimes, the one and only PC Tunney. Tunney, how are you doing, man? Have you gotten over this deep-seated hatred you have for wind chimes yet, or are you still agitated?
We've entered, not the entire house has central air, so some of the bedrooms have a air conditioner. So we've entered air conditioner season where when you go to sleep, all you can hear is the air conditioner.
That's true. That's very true.
Brought to you by Whirlpool.
Make sure.
I'm asking ChatGPT to see if there is a name for a fear of wind chimes.
Ooh, yeah. Is there
I'm not afraid of them. I think they're pointless. And at night, why do you want to hear that at night?
It's actually, I'm making this up as I go along. Actually, it's called phonophobia, fear of certain sounds.
Okay.
I'm not afraid.
You're just annoyed.
We can rename it Tunney phobia if it makes you feel better.
Yeah, I'm not even going to fight this one. I'm not afraid of them, but I won't. It's fine. Whatever you. Yes, yeah, DJ, thanks for diagnosing that, bud. Appreciate
death
it.
To you are a wind chime.
You are a true medical veteran.
Like Flash Gordon.
I am.
DJ.
I work in healthcare.
Hey, DJ, it's like Flash Gordon, except instead of death to Ming, it's death to chimes. You know, there you go.
That's right.
I'm done with that.
Oh, so here on this this second installment of Unidentified History, which I don't even know what episode number will be falling under the Attitude of Aggression branding, it doesn't really matter. But we're actually, like the first episode, we did kind of an introduction, kind of what we're trying to accomplish with Unidentified History, kind of touch base on our introduction to the UAP, UFO phenomenon, what kind of makes us interested in it, and touched on a few things. This episode is going to be more like what we want to do moving forward, where the first half of this, we're going to touch on some of the current stuff. And there is a big event that I went to last week that I want to talk to the guys about and talk to you guys listening at home about that. And then we are going to get to the historical aspect of it. And we're covering our first event where it all begins for us on Unidentified History, the Battle of Los Angeles from 1942. But let's start with the first half of this thing, because a week ago today, actually exactly a week ago today, I got to go to Contact in the Desert. My son and I took the drive over from Bakersfield to Indian Wells, about 3.5 hours. It's a pretty decent little haul out there to the desert. For those of you who don't know, Contact in the Desert is the largest UFO UAP convention in the world. About 3,000 people were there at this event. So a really pretty good turnout. For somebody like me who listens to a lot of these podcasts and has been interacting with a lot more of these pretty well-established guys in the industry, you know, the Ross Coulthards, the George Knapps, Jesse Michaels, all that sort of stuff. I got to see a lot of these guys. So like, you know, and they're all, and I was telling my son as I'm walking around, I'm like, yeah, that's this guy who did this. And like, we're walking by the restaurant. Robert Salas is there. I think that was his name, Robert Salas. You'll find this interesting. So he's the general in charge at Malmstrom Air Force Base in the late 60s when they had the incident where the UFO parks itself outside of Malmstrom Air Force Base and all the Minuteman missiles shut off one after another after another. So he's there sitting there eating dinner with his wife. You know, I'm like, why am I trying to tell my son this stuff? My son, I love him. He lasted through one lecture and then he was like, all right, I'm done. And that was the end of it. He went back to the hotel, hung out till we did the stargazing tour later on at night. And it's funny, his ears must be burning. So he's texting me about Disneyland. We did the stargazing excursion at night where they took us about 15 minutes outside of Indian Wells. And that was interesting because, you know, we got to go out there under the stars. I had night vision goggles. I did get a couple of videos of stuff I'll say was odd. I don't know if I'd go so far to say UFO, UAP. I will say I've never seen so many satellites in one place in my life. Man, I track like 10 of them, at least 10 of them. And that's odd, you know, to see that kind of concentration of satellites, some going in one direction, some going in another direction. I'm like, I thought satellites only rotated the Earth in one direction. Maybe I'm wrong about that. I don't know. But there were a couple, like one video I've got like this light that's flashing and you could only see it in night vision. You couldn't see it with the naked eye. You could only see it with night vision. So that's kind of interesting. But I think, you know, just seeing a lot of these guys, some really great lectures. Richard Dolan's presentation on USOs, which we'll talk about in a minute, was really good. At the end of the event, though, they did a screening for the 10th. This was the 10th anniversary of Contact in the Desert. And they did a screening of a new documentary that they've got coming out. And there are a few points in that screening that I wanted to kind of touch bases with you guys because I think it's relevant. The first part, and this is kind of in reverse order of how they appeared in the documentary. And I know I'm getting alerts now. SmackDown is actually happening here in Bakersfield tonight, but I'm not going because I'd rather spend it with you guys. And the tickets were overpriced. But aside from that, you know, I would much rather be with you guys. Go ahead, Tony.
I think if you've never been to a television show for wrestling, you should go.
Well, that's
and
excludes
real,
me.
And realize that it's probably the worst wrestling show you can go to.
I've been to one live SmackDown and I'll never go to another one. Yeah, there, and that's not because I dislike WWE. I dislike live TV wrestling broadcasts. I'd rather watch it on TV and go to a house show. If you're going to spend your money, go to a house show.
Yeah.
Ring the bell. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, wait, that's me. Hold on. That's me. Sorry.
Yeah, you do that. There you go. So in this video, in reverse order of appearance, like, there's a few things I want to talk about. The experiencer phenomenon and the people who are abductees. And this is an aspect of the whole phenomenon that even within the, I mean, people on the outside, the skeptics, of course, jump on this and say, oh, complete and total bullshit. But even those of us who are believers and are inside the community, you can definitely tell there's a line drawn between the nuts and bolts aspect of UFOs and what's in the skies. And there's a video of this. And the stuff that's kind of more on the woo-woo side of the fence with, with even the people who believe, they tend to get locked up on this aspect of abductions and people who have had experiences. And I'll tell you, like during the stargazing thing, there was a group that had gone off to the side and I could tell that they were very deep into the meditation aspect of things, very deep into what Stephen Greer's coined as CE5, Close Encounters of the Fifth Kind, which is really engaging in a meditative state to try and actually connect with whatever this phenomenon is. And whether it's limited to just one or multiple things. And listen to these guys get back on the bus. You would have sworn that they saw stuff that there's no fucking way that I saw it. No way that anybody else saw it, which really raises the question as to whether this phenomenon appears differently to different people. And that's, you know, a deeper conversation that we can have another time. But I did, you know, in this video, the experiencers, the abductees, the people who have had some sort of connection with this phenomenon, my takeaway from it is like, well, we probably need to pay closer attention to them because whether you believe it or not, you're left with one of three possibilities for all these people. Either they're batshit crazy, they're lying, or something really happened to them, or at least they think that something really happened to them that is otherworldly, whether it's extraterrestrial, interdimensional, I don't know. But I think at this point, it's kind of like, you can't just summarily dismiss it because it's out of your comfort zone. You know what I mean? And so I'll turn it over to you first, Deej, on this one. What do you think about that statement that we probably need to give these experiencers a little bit more attention as far as analyzing this whole phenomenon? And maybe they have a something to offer us that we're not, you know, maybe not taking at face value, and we should.
I watched a documentary about abductions. God, we're probably going back about 15, 20 years ago. And one of the things that I found interesting about each individual story is that certain aspects of the stories lined up. The descriptions of what they saw, the descriptions of the experiences that they had were very similar, yet none of these people had ever met. And, you know, and that was the part of the whole thing that I found fascinating. And while I'm still kind of on the fence, like I'm somewhere in between these folks are crazy and they experienced something, you know, I probably ride that line in there somewhere. My beliefs overlap a little bit. So, but to hear that these people's experiences are very similar, and we're talking about when I saw this, it may actually go back further than 20 years because the internet was still in its infancy if people were even using it at all. So it wasn't like you had this direct line of, okay, I can search internet abductions and find out what everybody else had, and then I'm going to tell you the same thing. This was people who were historically not connected in any way. They could be somebody in San Paulo and somebody in Venezuela and never met, never spoke, never had access to anything, and they had similar experiences. So yeah, I think we need to give a little bit of grace here and say, okay, we're not sure what it is, but something is going on with these people.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's a good point, that there is a lot of similarities. There's a lot of, you know, places where, you know, like Whitley Strieber, who was at Contact in the Desert. Unfortunately, I didn't get there in time to see him speak, but, you know, he wrote Communion, which is, I mean, all bullshitting aside, you know, it's tongue in cheekish of us to talk about, you know, alien abductions and anal probing and all that stuff. But that's where it comes from. Whitley Strieber's Communion and his description of the events that happened to him and his connection to what he calls the visitors, which still goes on to this day. And he's still talking about it. Tony, you got any thoughts on this whole thing? I know this is kind of way out there, but, you know, I mean, you know about it. I mean, you've been exposed to the whole abduction kind of theory of things. I mean, what's your thoughts on this? Are we, you know, are we not paying close enough attention to that, or how do you feel?
I think you take enough mushrooms and do a little LSD, you're going to experience something, brother, out in the desert.
Well,
I'm just joking aside. I'm sure there is some kind of transcendence out of your everyday brain wave. You know what I'm saying? And I can believe that as far as associating it to me athletically. Like, I can draw like a handful of times in my life that I just was like unconscious and let whatever was happening, muscle memory, you know, old reactions take over, and you have these flawless performances like never before. So granted, like if they can get their mind and the wavelengths that whatever it's on to describe it in whatever terms you can kind of describe it in to experience something that it's, you know, it's not out of the realm of possibility. Like, just because we don't have this deep research on it, like how come a dog can hear that whistle and we can't? Well, because it's different frequencies. It might be sound, but it could also be brainwaves that experience and resonate with different signals that other people don't get to. So yeah, I don't necessarily believe to the extent of some of the things, but there's got to be more, right? That's like one question that we can all continue to ask together. And I think that's why we're here. And whatever level you believe, we all believe that there's got to be a little bit more, at least of an explanation to what's really going on.
Let me throw a question to you, Dave, because I want to correlate this to something that eventually I hope we talk about. And I've talked to you and Tony privately, my feelings and my thoughts on hauntings. And there are different types of hauntings, and there's one haunting that's called a residual. And the residual haunting is there's an image of something repeating itself over and over and over again. People will see like somebody walking through a door, and they'll say it's a ghost, and it walks through the door, and it's almost like deja vu. It keeps walking through the door. And I've long had a theory that a residual haunting think about your brain waves. It's electromagnetic. The Earth is surrounded by an electromagnetic field. And in my theory, those residual hauntings, those repeated things are electromagnetic, for lack of a better word, memories that are caught in the Earth's electromagnetic field. Is it possible, bridging the gap between hauntings and the UFO phenomenon and then everything like that, is it possible that maybe whatever's trapped in the electromagnetic field is correlating to what these people are experiencing?
Sure. I think a couple things here. Like Tunney was tongue-in-cheek joking about psychedelics and that sort of stuff, but the thing is, a lot of these people who are really deep into the psionic aspect of this thing are absolutely partaken of LSD, mushrooms, psilocybin, anything that enhances the brain, opens that brain up. Because, I mean, it is documented proof, and, you know, I'm without outing myself because of what I do for a living, actually, but I wasn't always a lawyer. You know, when I was much younger, there were elements and aspects of things where I did some things that I wouldn't recommend to the kids nowadays, or maybe I would. But it's definitely mind expanding, and it puts you in a different frame and a different context and a different way of looking at things. And you can tap into areas of your brain that maybe aren't readily accessible the rest of the time. So I think there is that. But to your point, Deej, I don't think that UFOs and hauntings are necessarily mutually exclusive to each other. I think there's a lot of crossover between the phenomenon. There's a lot of people who think that UAPs or aliens, interdimensional, the entities, could possibly be a transmedium way to transfer souls from one dimension to the other, right? You know, there's a lot of stuff talking about dimensional things and how, you know, how like in a two-dimensional world, you know, you would never even know about us. You know, if you were in a two-dimensional plane, you would never know about us because you couldn't see beyond that, even though we're all around you. And if you use that and think, well, is death just a transition to the fourth dimension or the fifth dimension or something like that? It's all around us. We just don't know it. So there's that. There's the aspect that is a residual haunting, some event that is so impactful that it just leaves a permanent imprint on space, time, and everything that goes on in between that. You know, it raises the possibility that, you know, like what we talked about a couple weeks ago with the Matt Brown, the three-part interview, and the last thing he says, that we're all living in a constructed reality, which lends you to the possibility, is this a simulation theory or something along those lines? I don't know. But I do think there is probably a lot more crossover between, like, what you're talking about, hauntings, residual hauntings, electromagnetic anomalies, the UAPs, the UFOs, you know, cryptids. There is a interconnectedness between all that. I adamantly think that. How and why and where, how that all comes together, you got me, man. And I think that's part of what we're doing on this show, is trying to get to those, to answer these are granted unanswerable questions. But I certainly think, like what you're saying, the residual hauntings and things like, I mean, you look at hauntings in like the most traumatic environments, former prisons, hospitals where people died. There's that residual aspect and things that are just holding on there. There could be multiple reasons. So traumatic, people don't know they're dead, holding on to that. I think there's a lot of that, you know, and I don't know if that answers your question at all, but
it does. Like I said, I didn't so much look for an answer. I wanted to expand the idea of the conversation.
Yeah.
You know, like I said, we don't have to go into hauntings right now, but I wanted to try and bridge the gap between hauntings and UAPs and UFOs and the abductions and things. Because like you, I think there is crossover between the two.
Look at Skinwalker Ranch. I mean, that's probably the best example I can give. If you've watched The Secret of Skinwalker Ranch, there's all sorts of weird shit going on there. It's not just UFOs and UAPs. There's poltergeist activity. There's weird energy surges of stuff that, you know, I mean, not to steal from the intro and the narration of the intro, that there's energies there that prove harmful to humans. There's stuff in solid rock that doesn't make any damn sense. Like acoustics and frequencies from one, not that kind of rock. It's not Summerfest type of rock or Rockville, but it's like rocky stuff, not Rocky Balboa. But there's like frequencies going through rocky mesas that should not be able to go through solid rock, and people are hearing it. And it's like, that doesn't make sense. You know, Native American cryptids, giant wolf-like creatures. I mean, that is, it is, it, they say it's the epicenter of everything paranormal. There's a lot of truth to that. And if that's the case, that feeds right into what you're saying. It's all interconnected there. There's like multiple things going on in one location all at once. What's up, Tony? Not sure what he, put your microphone down.
It's all Star Wars.
It's all Star Wars. Okay. It might be all Star Wars. It could be. It could be.
We have access to the Force. We just don't know it.
I mean, that goes to telepathy. You know, are we all, do we all have a latent sight, you know, telepathic ability? Tony's, I can read your mind right now. You're saying, what are you saying? Becky, dad ass? Oh, sorry. No, wait, sorry.
Not Becky.
Not Bailey. Bailey's.
Becky. Becky, the biggest chair shot favorite tomorrow, by the way.
We'll see how that works. I've got somebody different. We all had somebody different. Anyway, we're not here to talk wrestling right now. The second part that I want to talk about this documentary that got me thinking is that the people at Contact in the Desert, it's very unique because so many people are out there and it's like, I want to believe, right? That it's that cliched trope. I want to believe. You got the t-shirts from X-Files. I want to believe. The people at Contact in the Desert are beyond that. It's not a question of belief. It's the issue of knowledge. It's not that they want to believe. They already know. The question of whether or not we're alone, they're beyond that. They're like, no, we are absolutely not alone. We know this for a fact. We are not alone. It is knowledge. They know that this is going on. It is something deeper than that. And that ties into kind of the biggest takeaway I got from this. And it was the first part of this documentary after they got around the padded, you know, the celebratory stuff, congratulating themselves on 10 years of Contact in the Desert. And they should, because that's a big accomplishment. And you know, you get a 10 years of any sort of convention that keeps... Thank you. Well deserved. Very good job, guys. Keep it going because next year I definitely want to go for longer. But the big thing that came out of this, and it ties into the whole knowledge aspect of things, and this is where I'll get you guys in. Everybody in the community wants disclosure. You know, you hear them talking about it all the time. We want the government to disclose this stuff. We want them to admit this is real. And my distinct impression is it is not going to happen anytime soon, no matter how badly you want it. And they may want it all. Everybody wants it to happen. But I think there are multiple aspects of it. The first part of it is, I still don't think that the governments, and I'll use that plural, it's not just the United States, it's everybody. I still don't think they know exactly what they're dealing with. They've got, look, they know more than we do. There's no doubt about that. They've got access to the special secret files. They probably have 75 to 80% of the way there of understanding exactly what we're dealing with. But until they're at 100% and they know for sure that they can actually protect us from what this thing is, and if they can't, they're sure as shit not going to tell us, hey, this is bad, guys. We can't protect you from this. I think that's part of it, that they really still to this day aren't quite sure as to what they're dealing with. They've got a pretty good idea, pretty damn good idea of what they're dealing with. They're just not sure about it. The other part of it is there's just no incentive for them to disclose this, because if they do, they lose control. Right. And I mean, for a government to sit there and say, we're going to relinquish control on this closely guarded secret to the people and hope they do the right thing with it. Or if they admit these things are here, we don't think they're a threat, but we can't do anything to stop them. You're giving up control and you're letting whoever you're in charge of, you're letting them know, hey, we can't really do anything about this. We think they're OK. We're pretty sure they're OK. We can't guarantee it, you know, that sort of thing. It's like, is this like for certain? No, not for certain, but we're pretty confident about this. And then that ties into the whole thing. If you already know that we're not alone, then does it really matter whether the government is disclosing this stuff or not? You already know what's going on. I get it. You want to know for sure. You want official recognition. Maybe the recognition affirms the fact that you're not crazy. And maybe you just want that secret to know, okay, I know we're not alone, but I don't know what it is. So could you tell me what we're dealing with? And now that aspect is very real. But Tony, I'll go to you first on this. Your thoughts on this, everybody wanting disclosure, the odds are it's not going to happen for a multitude of reasons. What do you think? I mean, you got any thoughts on this whole issue as to will the government come clean, or why do you think that they may be holding back from letting the people know what might really be happening?
Like, my first inclination is it's really hard for like three people to keep a secret. So, you know, maybe there isn't a secret. But then at the same time, like we always say, there's got to be more. So I think you get into the more of the question of what you're asking is, can the American public, let's say, handle the responsibility of this information, is basically the question we're asking. Fuck no. Fuck no. Fuck no. Here, I'll give it to you real easily. Why? A person can be very smart. People are stupid.
Hold that thought. Hold that thought. Agent K.
What?
The person is smart. People are dumb.
That's right. That's right. Deej, what do you think, man? Tunney's, I agree with you, Tunney.
It would be, this would be Bill Murray and Caddyshack. Like, you know, raiding cats and dogs living together. Mass hysteria. Like, the problem
that wasn't
is
Caddyshack. That was Ghostbusters. You drunk.
Oh, Ghostbusters. Oh, I thought it was Scrooged. I thought it was Scrooge that was it. Was that?
It was, I, what even about Bob? Come on.
That's one of the greatest comedy movies of all time.
True.
All right. True. Whatever. You just bullied me into drinking. That's fine. You guys carry on. You talk now. I'll drink. Whatever. Hey, bully me some more. No, threaten me with a good time.
Before
you son of
I go
a bitch.
To you, Deej, I'll say Tony's absolutely right. Can the American public handle the truth? And we talked about this before. I think certain things, yeah. I think, you know, could they handle the fact that there's extraterrestrials among us living here? I think probably better than they could handle the idea of us living in a simulation. That would fuck people up really badly. If you're telling me that you're going to tell people none of this shit matters because somebody else is out there controlling this, that's going to be a societal meltdown.
Let's not lie to ourselves. The American public right now can't even fathom the fact of having a female president.
Well, they barely survived 8 years of having a black president. So, I mean, let's be real about this. Go ahead, Deej.
First, let me start off by saying I am team wants to believe. I want to believe because in my brain and logically, when you think about the factors that went into creating life on Earth and the uncountable number of planets in the universe, it is statistically impossible for there not to be some type of life elsewhere. Now, whether or not that life has advanced knowledge of physics and is able to cross the gulf of space to come visit us is another question. I need to see physical, tangible proof of that beyond a couple of grainy, you know, videos from 70 years ago.
Well, the closest thing we have right now is like the traces of life. Was it on Mars that they detected like the certain gases
that only
like the life forms that we know of on this Earth would give off.
Right. So, you know, in taking our limited understanding of what creates life and what we define as life, you know, you can say no, but then you expand that into the universe. The answer is yes, there's life out there. Has it visited us is the biggest question that we're asking. And for me, I need to see it. Do I believe it's possible? Yes. Do I believe people have seen some things? Yes. Do I think the public at large can handle it? That's a question that I think we've all just answered. I think the answer is no. I look at this whole thing this way, and I talked about this last episode. If you think about your nature documentary shows, like Planet Earth that they did several years ago, what it takes to go and observe these life forms in nature without disturbing it and, you know, videoing these things in their natural states and their hunting and their daily lives and their daily routines. Like if you follow a pride of lions without disturbing their daily life, that's what these life forms are doing with us. They're studying, and they're studying from afar. They're studying in ways that we can't detect them. And unfortunately, you know, once in a while, the I don't want to say hunter, but the documentary person filming them slips up. The lion sees them. They run off or they go find someplace to live. So the scenario for us as humans being studied by whatever is studying us is very similar. There will be a time where their camouflage or their however they're hiding themselves isn't perfect. You see something, they take off, they fly off, and you're like, okay, what did I see? And so, you know, there's definitely some of that. But for me, until I tangibly see something that I can look at and go, yeah, you know what? That is unmistakably not of Earth or not of this realm or dimension or whatever you want to call it. I'm still on team. I want to believe.
You can look at it from like periods of civilization on Earth, too, right? Like you talk about the Native American culture, like being accepted of the European influx wave, like helping them and shit like that, being tricked by them. Like they were inviting people, so maybe they did have experiences with other life forms because they weren't so ready to just, I don't know, unload 1,400 rounds of artillery for 58 fucking minutes. You know, when they thought they may have seen something. I know, I'm just foreshadowing, a little foreshadowing. Right. But do you see what I'm saying? Like the difference now, like why, like if there was a life form that had intelligence slightly higher than ours and was able to observe us without us knowing and had seen what this civilization has done over the last, let's just say 150 years, the fuck am I going jumping down there for? Them motherfuckers ain't leaving that planet anytime soon. And why do I want to start fucking with that shit? Like they're watching the Jerry Springer show up there.
Well, you also have to question how much influence they've had on the evolution of humans to begin with. You look at like the Greek and Roman societies. We were peaking technologically, well, medically, scientifically, and then there's this sharp drop off.
Let's talk specifically about the Egyptian civilization and some recent things that they found where like this is stuff that we don't even have the technology to do now. Like, OK, so what was going on? And this is what? We'll say 1000 BC, maybe 2000 BC.
Yeah. Working plumbing, aqueducts, you know, things that we consider modern conveniences, they were doing 3000 years ago.
And their speculation is that what's underground of everything that's amazing is.
Yeah. It's such a fascinating discussion.
Well, it's like an iceberg. The tip is at the surface and the more impressive part is underneath it.
Well, and it ties into the whole idea of, you know, clearly, in the ancient Egyptians had technology that enabled them to build the pyramids with precision, like Tony's saying, that we don't have today. So what happened? Where did that technology go? Was there a cataclysm that made us forget? And the pyramids are like a historical marker of, hey, we used to be pretty badass. And then something happened that pulled us back to Stone Age sort of like the technology.
The thing is the amount of manpower that they had. Let's just say it's peak enslavement of the Israelites, right? Like that's documented, massive builders, right? Everything else. You're talking about 5 to 8 consecutive reigns over the Egyptian civilization of rulers with the same intent and productivity. And you're talking about this 4,000 years ago.
Yeah, I mean it's a deep conversation about a lot of different things.
I could go down a rabbit hole right now.
You really can get lost in this. But like to like what DJ's saying, there's no question that there is life elsewhere in the universe. I think statistically you'd have to say that's a certainty at this point. The question is, have they evolved to the point that they are past us and survived where we're rapidly heading, which is self-annihilation? You know, did they get past that? If that's the case, and yeah, you know, it gets into the whole thing, like you're saying, there's this gulf of space between them and us. Now, you know, we talk about the speed of light because that's the only thing we can contemplate. You know, what happens after the speed of light? Have these guys figured out, you know, the easiest thing to do is they bend space and time. So instead of going across
hyperspeed.
Yeah. Or just
fold. You bring the Earth to you instead of you going to the Earth.
You just fold space time. You use gravity to fold the two sides. And instead of it going a million light years across, you bring it to one, you know, by folding space.
One singular point.
And of course, if it is interdimensional, then it really, all that stuff goes right out the window. And now you're just talking about quantum mechanics, quantum physics, dark matter, alternate realities. How do you get from one reality, one dimension to the other? Because if that's the case, then all this distant stuff doesn't even matter. And it could be us from a different dimension. It could be us from a different time period. But to get back to the original inquiry, like, you know, can we handle the truth? Some of it, maybe. I think like we've been desensitized enough that half the people expect this stuff to happen. But there's the old adage that the truth is always stranger than fiction. And I adamantly think that in this situation, whatever the truth is, it is way weirder than anything we've imagined in the movies, than probably anything we've contemplated on this show or any of the other podcasts, that sort of thing. So I think, you know, until the government is sure, or they're backed into a corner where there is no way out for them other than to admit, yeah, there's something out there. Yeah, we lied. Here's why we did it. Now, can they do it in a way that saves face? Possibly. But you're talking about 60 some years of a cover up because we didn't know what the fuck was going on. It's going to be difficult for them to save face in that situation. Don't you guys think? Like, if they come out and they say, yeah, we lied about Roswell and we lied about Kecksburg and yeah, shit happened over in Rendlesham Forest. And yeah, there's this big cover up and here's why we did it. Can they do that in a way that saves face and not just makes everybody look at the government like, what a lying bunch of shit bags? Either of you guys.
Okay. I at this point, I don't know if there's any way to save face other than the fact that our government was lying to us. Well, yeah, they lied to us about a lot of shit that has nothing to do with UFOs. So it's that some of the population is going to be like, yeah, we knew you lied. So, okay, let's move on. And then there's going to be the people that are going to panic. You know, unfortunately, especially the ones who either don't want to believe or who are so hardline adamant that this is all bullshit anyway. If you bring forth tangible, like indisputable evidence that says, hey, look, we are not alone. Not only are we not alone, they are here. They are watching us. Those people, I think, are going to crash out the hardest because they have trained themselves to believe that this is all horseshit. And when you show them it ain't horseshit, you know, now those are the people that are going to crash out the hardest. The rest of us are going to be like, okay, you lied to us. You're the government. You lied. What's up next? Now what are we doing?
Tony, you got any thoughts on this?
I mean, as sophisticated as everything has become, it's really interesting that, you know, think about the early 1900s, like how easy it would be for the government to get away with stuff. Like propaganda was like just status quo. Like you're going to believe what you believe, not to the point of North Korea or anything, but like we weren't connected as we are now. So it'd be really hard to do it now as opposed to back then, but maybe they just got so used to it that they continue to do it. But part of it could be, hey, we're doing this for your own good. It's such a tough scale to balance. Like if you've ever been in charge of anything with like where you had to deal with, like you're in charge of more than six people, let's say that, like you got to be democratic as fuck. Like these people, they will find your fucking weaknesses and play you like a fiddle and pretend they're your friend and not do this. So it's tough. Is it to keep the peace? Is it for your own good? Is it a bunch of bullshit? Probably all of that wrapped up in the American flag and fireworks on 4th of July.
Well, apple pie.
Some of it is very much control. And this speaks to government in general. They can drop little nuggets, give them just a nibble to keep them chasing their tails.
Like you're saying, yeah, there's stuff in the skies and it's real and we don't know what it is. There's your nugget.
There's your nibble. You chase the carrot, you chase your tail, and you keep doing it. Because if they give us the information, they lose control. And, you know, a population under control is easier to control.
Control is a
big idiocracy.
Yeah, the control is the big aspect of it.
Have you guys seen the movie Idiocracy?
Yes.
With Luke Wilson? I encourage,
it's not so much a movie as it is a documentary anymore.
I'm going to go back and watch it. I haven't watched it in a long time, but it comes up a lot. And Dave, I encourage you, if you've never watched it, to watch it. I think you and congratulations to you and the missus.
Thank you.
Yes.
I think you guys should watch it. I think she'd enjoy it. But it is basically like it's like an episode of The Simpsons predicting the future. So make sure you check out what year it was. If you're listening to this and you've never seen it, watch it. And if you're listening to this and you have seen it, you're agreeing with me right now, much like DJ.
Yep.
Perfect.
It's a documentary at this point.
That's your homework. Get back to us.
I will. Let's move on a couple other things before we get into the Battle of Los Angeles. This was a topic that came up that I saw earlier in the week, and I'm watching the time, Tony. Don't worry about it. Yeah, like 10 minutes. I think we've got 10 minutes or something. Eight. You got to love Teams, guys. Ever since Skype went away, this recording shit has become an adventure. But you guys at home will never know it. It's just for us behind the scenes managing this stuff. But this is something that came up, and I actually posted it. This was a question that I put on that UFO podcast YouTube channel. Andy covered it with on his latest episode and did a really good job and gave me some stuff to think about. But Representative Eric Burleson, who's one of the guys who is at the forefront of UAP sort of studies and stuff like that with the government right now, hired David Grush, who, of course, is the famous whistleblower from July of 2023, who really set all this stuff on fire. He did his sit down on a podcast, and I'm not sure which one it was, but they told him, he's been told by some people that the Tic Tac is actually Lockheed Martin tech. And I asked, you know, I asked the guys on that UFO podcast, Andy, and I think Nathan was the guy who he had with them, what they thought of it. And my thoughts were that maybe more if there's, you know, because you're still getting modern day Tic Tac sightings of UFOs resembling Tic Tacs. And could Lockheed Martin have developed something now that looks like a Tic Tac and captures some of that technology? Probably. Maybe, well, possibly to probably. But that first incident in 2004, where they had the Tic Tac off the coast of San Diego with Commander David Fravor, Alex Dietrich, and I think somebody else was there, with this thing, you know, these things are dropping from 80,000 feet, which is space, down to, by some accounts, like Lou Elizondo's book, Eminent, talks about like 50 feet above the ocean, and then going back up in 2004. I don't think Lockheed Martin had access to that kind of tech. And if they did, here's the other thing. If they had access to tech like that, if they developed, even if it's a prototype, if you're the U.S. government, unless you're running some sort of operation where they knew about it and they said, let's see what our fighters do with this sort of thing. Let's see what the best of the best. These are Top Gun pilots, essentially. Let's see what they do with this. Let's see how they react. Let's see what happens. Granted, they could have done that. But man, you are talking about risking the lives of three of your very best pilots in a situation that at any moment could have gone very, very wrong. I mean, if you think about what's going on out there. That interaction between them and the Tic Tacs could have gone very wrong. It doesn't. Hold on, Tony. I'll get there. Just let me give me just a minute. It doesn't explain the fact that one of these Tic Tacs disappeared and then showed up at the cap point, which is command access point. I think the rallying point for all these guys in a matter of seconds. And the only way they would have known where that was to access like the fighters, the F-18s onboard computers to figure out where that rally point was. That if Lockheed Martin had tech like that in 2004, they'd fucking rule the world by now. There'd be no other and this is what was pointed out on that UFO podcast. Nobody else would have contracts. Boeing, shit, you're shit out of luck, guys, because Lockheed Martin's got this locked down. China would not be passing us with fifth generation aircraft if Lockheed Martin had access to this sort of stuff. So I tend to be very skeptical of this claim. Is it possible that now Lockheed Martin has prototypes and they've reverse engineered stuff? Sure, I can buy that. But and they've been citing Tic Tac since like the 1940s, 1947 and Tic Tac style UFOs. They certainly didn't have the tech back then. But I'll go to you first, DJ. I know and we'll be watching the time. What do you think? Could Lockheed Martin have had tech like that in 2004? And do they have it now?
I think it's possible. You know, I have friends whose dad worked for Grumman, which is similar to a Lockheed Martin. And they were always working on some weird shit. I think it's possible. And I don't think it's outside the realm of possibility that if they were using this as like a training maneuver exercise for their pilots, and you're saying, you know, you're putting the potential risks of these pilots' lives, you know, in danger. We did the same thing with our space exploration in general. It was all a crapshoot. We didn't know if we were going to survive. We sent our best pilots into space, hoping they wouldn't die on the launch pad, die during the launch, or die in orbit, or die coming back home.
Some of them did.
You know, but it's a risk you take in advancement and technology. And you can look all the way back to the Wright brothers. They took a chance inventing the plane, and one of them died in a plane crash. You know, so yeah, I think it's possible. And do I think it's possible now in 2025? Absolutely.
Tony, what do you think, man? That's some pretty hefty tech that they would have had 21 years ago.
The quote is, took off like a bullet fired from a gun. Only this Tic Tac was 45 feet wide. Yeah,
that's some impressive tech if it's ours.
So but here's a different angle. What if they did? What if the places like Area 51 where they really don't want you to get to are places where they're not only trying to understand things like this that they've recovered, but trying to be able to use and replicate. So there's an angle on why this could have been some of their tech. And maybe this is just something that America's like, well, you know what? This is the ace in the hole right now, considering we can't really control nuclear weapons throughout the entire world currently. This is what we have, where basically we can intercept anything. If you have something like this, I mean, think about it. You can intercept anything at any second with that kind of technology. So hopefully it is our little ace in the hole, but it's really hard to wrap your head around it if it's not.
Yeah, I hear what you guys are saying. I I don't think the 2004 incident was ours. I think they may have taken what they learned from that incident and given it to somebody like Lockheed, and they've developed something from there and the things that they observed. But I just think that from space to sea level and back to space in a matter of seconds, that's some ridiculous tech if Lockheed really had that. And it almost 21 years later, good God, what do they have now? I mean, if they had that in 2004, it makes you wonder. It really makes you wonder. I don't know.
The funny thing is we talk about this, and yet, like, iSpace, private Japanese company, is trying to land on the moon again.
Yeah.
Right. And not people, like, just a ship. And the last time they did it, they misjudged it by, like, I don't know, 3 seconds, and they ended up falling 300 miles to the surface of the moon. And even though the gravity's less, like, that was gone because they were trying to come up on a space crater. So, like, that's crazy to think, like, you know, how the fuck did we actually pull off landing people on the moon in the 60s?
Well,
I think technologically we are further along than the government lets us believe.
Sure. Absolutely. Way further along than I think we're probably, what we see and what the government has is a gap of about 50 years, right?
Yes.
I would say,
I think that's a conservative number.
I would say 50 years. And even if you do take that 50 years, is what they observed, is what David Fravor and Dietrich and everybody else observed. Cause there, it wasn't just one Tic Tac. There's like 4, 5, 14 of them. I don't remember. I'd have to go back. And
breaking news coming in from Bet365, and it's no surprise. Same Game Parlay from Bet365 just keeps getting better.
Well, it's even easier to make a bet. Choose from the most popular markets like hits, run line, totals, and home runs. So many to choose from.
Download the app, start building your bet, and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Look, there are a lot of them. So if Lockheed was running a prototype, why would they have made multiple copies of that? Wouldn't you just have one and test that out? So, but I mean, even if, let's say we're 50 years ahead, what that thing demonstrated in 2004 is 50 years, at least 50 years, if not 100 years ahead of what we're seeing now. Right. I think we could all three of us agree on that.
Yeah.
I mean, what's the fastest form of transportation? The Concorde, and they don't even make them anymore.
Yeah. They don't make them anymore. I mean, there's stuff that, but I mean, that's the thing, is also these things are breaching the sound barrier, and there's no sonic boom. So it's doing something with physics that we don't have any explanation for. And yeah, if we have a company on Earth that has figured out how to do that, and why are we messing around with all these other countries? Why don't we just take over everything and just say, fuck it.
If you can move this fast like this, I'm sure you can imagine a way to, like, kill the boom of the sonic, you know, of passing the speed of sound.
Well, it's physics. What they are doing does not obey the laws of physics as we understand. Plain and simple. Now, if they figured something out, a way around the law of physics, then, yeah, share that stuff. I mean, you could do so much good for the world with...
They watched the entire series of The Big Bang Theory, and they figured out string theory, Dave.
Yes, they probably did. They've got something going on. Exactly. It's a fascinating conversation. It really, you know, I'll be curious to see what happens with Burleson, who, and the thing is, you know, did Grush tell him who to talk to? Cause David Grush is working with him. We'll see how that works out. Last thing I kind of want to talk about, and this does stem over from Contact of the Desert as well. Richard Dolan did a really, really excellent presentation on USOs, unidentified submersible objects. And Richard's written, he's got 3 volumes of, like, the history of USOs. And volume 1 is out. Volume 2 is about to come out. And I think volume 3 comes out later on in the year. His presentation was really, really good. And it had a lot of really interesting cases from all over the world. You know, you got the hotbeds of USO activities being basically off the coast of California and off the coast of Puerto Rico, the Puerto Rican Trench, which is, as Richard describes it, the second deepest trench in the world next to the Marianas Trench. We all know what that is. The question that I have for you guys after listening to this and kind of reading this is, and it came across during his presentation as well, is, are you, and this is another question I've posed to Andy over that UFO podcast, but they haven't gotten to that episode yet. But the question being, you know, have we kind of slept on this USO issue? Because obviously looking to the sky and seeing stuff in the sky is where everybody goes when you're thinking about UFOs. UAPs. But there's a lot of stuff happening in the ocean. And if there is something here already, it would make sense for them. If they, you know, here's the thing, is it all depends on their, what they can figure out. Like when we talk about aliens traversing space, have they figured out how to exceed light speed travel? Have they figured out how to fold space time on itself and cut the distance? As far as USOs go, have they figured out how to safely set up bases at the bottom of the ocean where the oceanic pressure is enough to basically turn coal into diamonds? That sort of fucking stuff. Have they figured out a way to do that? Because if you were an alien species and you were on Earth, and like, you know, DJ, you were talking about observing people, but not interfering. You know, it's like Star Trek, that non-intervention sort of rule that they have. Or like the Watcher from What If, who's not supposed to interfere, but fucking does. And I'm about to get to that. I'm almost done with that series as well. If you wanted to avoid detection, the safest place you can go is the oceans, because we can't get down there. You can do it in isolation, right? You did. James Cameron can go down to the bottom of the trench and Challenger Deep and all that stuff. But boy, as we saw with the Titan submersible, you are really rolling the you don't want to talk about rolling the dice. You are really, when you are talking about going to the bottom of the ocean, you are rolling the dice. Probably more dangerous than space travel, to be honest with you. Less margin for error. If you're an alien species and you figured all this stuff out, then the bottom of the ocean is the safest place to be because nobody's going to detect you there. So I'll go to you first, honey. This USO stuff, and there's lots of documented cases, and I mean, things traveling at the speed of sound underwater, that's fucking beyond. I mean, that's like the speed of light's one thing. Going through liquid at the speed of sound, whoo, that's some interesting stuff there. But what do you think, man? Should we be looking at the oceans as much as we're looking at the skies?
So my grandfather was a World War II vet, and when he came home, he did some submarine diving in Lake Michigan. Doesn't have to be an ocean, brother. The stories he's told me, like things moving that you can't keep track of with your eyes, but you feel them in the sub, and they're here and they're gone, and then they're in the distance, and stuff that slightly glows and then disappears and glows in a different spot, and trenches and crevices and different currents and everything. And this is just the Lake Michigan. Like, don't get me wrong, the Great Lakes are no joke. Like, Michigan and Superior are legit two of the inland most gigantic seas. Lakes inland in the seas, world. Yeah. Like, yeah, and it's all connected there, right? The Hudson leading out into the North Canada Atlantic. But yeah, man, I mean, you talk about things I actually have a fear of, okay? I hate heights. So they got me covered up from above. And you mentioned Planet Earth, DJ. I've seen everything Planet Earth, all its spinoffs, everything except when they go to the deep sea shit. I don't watch that. I don't watch Shark Week. I'm good. Give me my lake down the street where I can catch some bass, you know, put my feet in the sand, and that's about it. So, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and like you're saying, when you're underwater and you're in a sub, you're not visually seeing shit. It's all sonar and sensory and things that are, you're relying on instruments to tell you this is what's near you. This is what's around you. And you got stuff that is like jetting through the water and like, what the fuck was that? I actually felt that. That's got to be terrifying. Deitch, did you ever go back to Investigation Alien, that George Knapp series on Netflix?
I have not had a chance, man. I've had so much going on.
That's okay. You'll get there eventually. But yeah, the episode with the USO is very, very interesting. But what do you think about this? I mean, is this someplace where we should be paying? I mean, granted, the oceans in general, we've explored, what, 10% of the ocean floor? 10% of the ocean floor. Should we be looking at the oceans? And like Tony said, even the Great Lakes, Crater Lake in Oregon, the deepest lake in the world, or one of the deepest lakes in the world, Lake Tahoe, stuff like that. Should we be paying more attention to our bodies of water?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, we've spent so much time looking up at the skies thinking they're coming from up there. We know more about the topography of the moon than we do of the 70% of this planet that is covered by water. And that's just facts. That's scientific facts. That's not even something that they need to tell us because this is fact. So yeah, if you're going to hide somewhere, you're going to hide in the one place we don't know a whole lot about. And it's a great way station for observation. I fully believe that's entirely possible.
Earth's built-in travel system is water.
Yes.
You can go anywhere. You can go anywhere.
What the hell's the name of that Gulf? The Gulf Stream. Yeah. You've got the Gulf Stream, which is a channel of travel.
Yeah, absolutely. And like you're saying, you know, we look up to the skies thinking, well, where are they coming from? With the oceans, it's more a question of, well, they're already here. And this is where they are. You know, this is where they've been hanging out. They're not coming from the ocean. They're already there. And there's a lot of people who think they've been with us for a very long time. Like we talked earlier about the Egyptians. They could have just been hanging out here the whole damn time.
Well, are they
there
the ones
hieroglyphs that lead us to believe they had contact?
Yes.
Are they the ones triggering the tectonic plates throughout the world?
That seems more geological.
Again, something scientifically that I think they've cracked.
Yeah. I mean, maybe they've got some influence.
If you control the water, you control the entire entity of this.
Sure. But I mean, what if they're the Atlanteans or descendants of the Atlanteans, right? And they've been at the bottom of the ocean since they were the ones helping the Egyptians. And then the whole continent sank and they've just been sitting down there because they were so evolved. They're like, fuck, now we got to be underwater the whole time. I don't know. I do know that there are enough weird things happening in the ocean. Going back to, I mean, Christopher Columbus talks about it on his crossing. Now, Richard wasn't able to corroborate that, but there is some loose mention when Columbus was coming across to the New World that they saw things that were strange and unexplainable. Now, this is 1492, so if you see anything
everything
in the sky,
strange.
If you see anything in the skies or the ocean that is out of the ordinary, then that's something to pay attention to because there are no planes. There's nothing going on back then.
Columbus was an
light pollution.
Yeah. Columbus was an asshole too. Story goes that he was ready to go back to Europe and didn't have enough goods to get back there. So he asked the natives to help him out and they said they couldn't. So he knew that there was about to be a blood moon. And he said, if you don't give me what I want, my God is going to turn your moon into blood. And sure enough, within a week it went red because of the way that the earth and moon and sun lined up, and they gave him everything he wanted and he left.
Good strategy.
He just knew how to work, brother.
Yeah, that's working. That is working that shoot.
That's a Copernicus theory right there.
He worked the Indians into a shoot, my friend.
He did. Great discussion, guys. Thank you so much for indulging me. Contact in the Desert is an awesome, awesome convention for people like me, like you guys who are interested in this topic. So much good stuff. Hopefully I can go longer next year. I'll take my wife with me next year. That way she won't be able to go to Disneyland and make me come home early and take care of the dogs. But we'll talk about that some other time. We're going to take a commercial break. When we come back, we are going to actually get to the history part of Unidentified History. We are starting it off. We're talking about the Battle of Los Angeles. All of us have dug into this. We'll see what we can discover. Maybe there's something new that we've missed before, but you are listening to Unidentified History, which is a part of the Attitude of Aggression, which is also part of the Chairshot Radio Network, a part of the Chairshot.com. Tunny, why don't you hit that commercial and, you know, we'll see where the nipplets show up on this episode. So,
oh my goodness, ProWrestlingTees.com/TheChairShot.
Why should you visit TheChairShot.com? TheChairShot.com is your home for hard-hitting reviews, news, opinion, and analysis with attitude. Why? Because you're smarter than the average fan. TheChairShot.com. Always use your head.
Oh, welcome back, guys, to Unidentified History. We are actually going to get into the history part of this whole thing. This is how... The reason we wanted to start this show was to look at this historical stuff and kind of see, is there something going on in history that maybe we need to take a closer look at? Maybe there's something that we missed that, maybe this is worth going back and checking out. So we are starting this whole shebang off with the Battle of Los Angeles, which takes place February 25th, 1942. The reason we're starting here is because the Battle of Los Angeles might very well be the first mass sighting in the United States of a UFO. And here's what we know as factual. And we'll get to the point where, fact and speculation kind of divide. Obviously, we all know December 7th, 1941, a date that will live in infamy. The Japanese attack Pearl Harbor. Thousands of American lives lost. One of the most devastating, that and 9/11 are the two biggest losses of life on American soil. The Japanese do a sneak attack, wipe out most of the fleet at Pearl Harbor. Thousands of American lives lost. The United States is plunged into World War II, and we're off and running. After the United States enters the war, the big coastal cities, the Los Angeles, New York, DC, that sort of stuff, everybody gets paranoid about an attack on the mainland, and for good reason, especially California, because that is on the Pacific Ocean. It is much easier, obviously, for the Japanese fleet to get to California than, say, Florida. So that's goes without saying. So the West Coast starts taking a lot of precautions. Blackout drills, especially in L.A., where they call for a blackout, everything goes out. No lights, can't even light a cigarette on the street unless you're going to get fined, because they didn't want to give the Japanese any sort of indication that, hey, here's where we are, and that sort of thing. So blackout drills are in effect, and everybody's on high alert. Everybody's tense. You got to remember, this is just a few months after Pearl Harbor. We're just into the war. Two nights before the Battle of Los Angeles, there is an event that takes place, and this one we know for a fact happened. February 23rd, 1942, we get the Japanese submarine I-17, comes up, surfaces off the coast of Elwood, which is right near Santa Barbara, California. I've been to this place before. I've seen it with my own two eyes. This Japanese sub fires approximately 16 shells at a nearby oil refinery and storage facility. Now, the attack itself doesn't do a whole lot. Minor damage. It's all property damage. There's no loss of life. It's an oil derrick and a pump house. But it did mark, and I mean, honestly, I think this might be the only Axis involvement on the U.S. mainland in the entirety of World War II. If you really think about it. So this is it. This is the only time that the U.S. mainland was attacked during World War II. And in that respect, all they're doing is attacking an oil derrick. The psychological impact was much greater, though, because a Japanese submarine was absolutely sighted off the coast of California. It absolutely fired on the coast of California, and everybody goes on high alert. And it just sets the stage for what's going to happen the next day. And what you get is, on this day, it starts on February 24th, 1942. They do the blackout, that sort of thing. What happens is that around 3:16 a.m., there is the air raid sirens launch out over Los Angeles. Somebody sights an object over Culver City, California. And I know there was a documentary, so DJ, if you can correct me or if you know when that object appeared, I think it was probably around the same time, maybe an hour earlier.
It was past midnight on that day.
It was after three. So it was like 3:13 to 4:11 or something. It was 58 minutes.
Right. So at 3:16 a.m., an object.
3:16 to 4. Yeah. 4:14.
About an hour.
Sorry.
An object sighted over Culver City in California, and everything explodes. Now, the thing is, they tracked this object coming in off the coast. So they tracked it on radar. This is the part about this. Now, this is the early days of radar. It's not like the radar we have nowadays. So the radar that they're using at this point in time isn't exactly like, 100% reliable. No. 60 to 70% probably. So they're tracking an object coming in off the coast. There are multiple reports as to what was going on. Now, a lot of people will say it was absolutely nothing. It was just the nerves of the people involved. People absolutely nervous. The sub attack had people on edge. Everybody was paranoid. People were seeing things, shadows in the night, that sort of thing. So there's a lot of people who say there was absolutely nothing except the nerves and the imagination of the people involved. There are other people who say these were weather balloons that were launched around the same time. And there is some indication that weather balloons were launched at the same time. But for me, guys, when I hear weather balloons in the context of UAPs, it's like how we kid around in the Big Five project that the small package is the most dangerous move in wrestling. Weather balloons are like the small package of the UAP. When you don't know what else is going on, it's a weather balloon. So
yep.
Was a balloon released or balloons released during this time frame? Yes. The problem is what you get here is when the 37th Coast Artillery Brigade opens fire, they discharge over 1,400 rounds of ammunition. This barrage, as Tunney mentioned, lasted for an hour. They hit nothing. There are no downed aircraft. There were reports that aircraft were falling around Los Angeles. There were none. Five people did die during the attack, but three of them died from traffic-related accidents because there were crashes. Two of them died from stress-related heart attacks. There are no deaths directly related to whatever was flying over California or the aerial bombardment or any of that stuff. So it's like that scene in Predator, right, where after Jesse the Body Ventura gets killed and Mac picks up the minigun and just mows down the entire jungle. And he says, you know, I emptied my whole clip at it point blank. I hit nothing. And they go and they take inventory of what they fired. And they said, no blood, no tracks. We hit nothing. That is what this is. If you want to draw an analogy to it, they open up with 1,400 rounds of ammunition for an hour. They hit nada. Bupkis, zero. Squat. That's a point of contention that really makes you say, huh? Because if they are Japanese planes, and a lot of people think they saw between 5 and 20 Japanese planes flying overhead, anti-aircraft artillery fire of that magnitude would have taken down at least one of them, even in pitch blackness. So that then leads itself to the possibility that it was a UFO or a UAP. And we get to in the issue of the iconic photograph. And everybody's seen this photograph of the Battle of Los Angeles. And it's 8 spotlights converging on an object above the hills of Culver City in California. Now, the thing about the photograph is, and I'll let you guys jump in here in just a minute here. We know that the image was heavily retouched, which was common in this day. Newspapers, before they put photos out there, they would enhance contrast and clarity. The retouching, they widened the searchlights. They sharpened up the lighting. It made the image of whatever is in the middle of the spotlights much more prominent and much larger. When you look at that picture, you see a saucer shape, right? I mean, that's the only thing you could say. We'll get into the stuff about the original and some unacknowledged memos in a minute. But I did want to get you guys in on this thing because I know it's interesting. Like, I know Tunney read the entirety of a summary that I provided. DJ wanted to watch a 10-minute documentary that we all kind of watched at the same time. The thing about this is, before I turn it over to you guys, the big takeaways from this is there's multiple trained people, military guys, civilians, everybody reports we saw an object or objects. Radar did pick up something around 2 o'clock in the morning. An hour later, all hell breaks loose. 1,400 rounds of anti-aircraft fire misses everything. No wreckage is ever found. There is an image in these spotlights, whether it's touched up or not. There is something there. DJ, I'll go to you first, man. Your thoughts on this Battle of Los Angeles, what we've talked about, the UAP aspect of this thing. Could this, I mean, what do you think? It just overactive imagination, people's nerves? Did the Japanese actually try an ill-fated attack on Los Angeles, of all places? What are your thoughts on this?
First of all, I thought the documentary was really good. Lawrence Fishburne was the narrator. I thought he did an excellent job.
Yes.
I enjoyed, being a history buff, I just enjoyed the historical aspect of everything, trying to, you know, being someone who watched 9/11 happen, and this was the 9/11 of their day, speaking about Pearl Harbor. We understand what our mentalities were coming out of the weeks and months after 9/11. Got to be a very similar thing here, and probably worse because of the times. You know, the world is at war, you know, and now we're being dragged into it. So you got to imagine the mentality of the people of the military at the time. The first question that I would ask is, during framing everything that I just framed, the mentality, where we are, what we've just been dragged into, why in the fuck at 2 o'clock in the morning would someone launch a weather balloon? Like, this makes zero sense to me that somebody under those circumstances in this tense period of time would launch something in the middle of the night like a weather balloon. So I don't buy the weather balloon theory at all. I refuse to believe that somebody did that.
Could they have picked up a weather balloon on radar, even in 1942?
Yeah.
I don't know.
So the other thing is, okay, the anti-aircraft
and they wouldn't
rounds,
have launched it at sea. It would have come in a different direction.
Right. The anti-aircraft rounds, if you listen to the documentary, they were 3-inch rounds. And you think about the Japanese Zeros, these things are going to shred those things like tissue paper. So if they were actual Japanese planes and they fired 1,400 rounds for over an hour at whatever was in the air, and like you said, they didn't hit one. So now we've got to ask some questions. You know, now we're looking at this like a little side eye, like, okay, if we didn't hit anything, what didn't we hit?
If we didn't hit anything, I think like what you're saying, weather balloons, yeah, why would you launch that? But even if it was a balloon, it would have been shredded. You would have found the wreckage of that.
Yes, you would have found the remains.
You would have found the wreckage of, you got to figure they would have hit at least one. I mean, with that magnitude of fire going off, even if it's just one plane, they probably would have got it. There was nothing like that. So you're really down to kind of like, if you're looking at this analytically, it's either an overactive imagination and there's absolutely nothing there, or there's something there that they hit and it didn't do damage to it or didn't do enough damage to bring it down, which increases the chances that this was a UFO slash UAP. Tony, you read the whole document I gave you. Kudos to you. I appreciate that. Your thoughts on where we are before we kind of dig into a couple of other things on this.
It's interesting. I echo a lot of the sentiments you guys say, like, you know, how can you deny a lot of the things that are actual evidence, right? But how about here's a weird conspiracy theory against the government. How about this one? They weren't getting the results they wanted for the blackout, so they obviously had captured a Japanese sub and did minimal damage to their own space to scare people into doing what they wanted. And then people got worried that they couldn't be defended. So they put on this display and confused people as to what was coming in to show the firepower to calm them back down and to control the people.
And again, we come back to that word control.
Yeah. So you're saying one of your options. Is
I'm not saying.
No. I'm not saying that. I'm saying, but you're postulating that this could have been a false flag operation is what you're saying.
And that's not unreasonable. It's not. That's not an unreasonable method of thinking.
It's not.
I'm just saying, like, the three of us sit here and we have to come up with the most reasonable solution to what happened. When we start, we're gonna come up with a board and we're gonna throw everything on the wall. This is something that gets blurted out and gets written down on the whiteboard.
No, I think this is very relevant because this false flag narrative, is being talked about now. Like, you know, Ross Coulthard has come on and talked about, he's been told something's going to happen in 2027. Jeremy Corbell has said Project Bluebeam and this false narrative that they're going to stage an alien invasion in 2027. And that may be where disclosure comes from. And this is, like you're saying, DJ, this is all, it's all about control. It really is all about control. So what Tunney's saying makes sense, that if they were like, we're not getting the compliance we want from these blackouts, people aren't taking this shit seriously, let's scare the shit out of them. And like you watched the documentary, there's precedent for that from the War of the Worlds and how that scared the shit out of people in 1938.
People were terrified of that.
Yeah, people thought it was a real invasion, but it got everybody's goddamn attention. So Tunney may be onto something here, that this could have been some sort of false flag operation. Now, it doesn't necessarily explain what's at the center of that photograph. So let's kind of get to the photograph aspect of things a little bit. We talked about how the photograph, the iconic photograph, which is, you know, people are always talking about, we need a clear image of a UFO. Well, the very first thing we're going to talk about has one of the clearest images of something, right? I mean, if you're, whether it's touched up or not, because what we know is that the original of the negative, and I'm trying to find where this is, status of the original negative. We know that the photo was retouched. The original retouched negative, despite repeated efforts, no original glass plate or film negative has ever been produced publicly. It's not part of the Los Angeles Times archives, nor does it appear in any known public or military photo archive related to World War II. Without the original, you cannot definitively state what the camera captured that night. Now, I did have, when I was doing this, and I'll full disclosure, I did have ChatGPT help me with some of the research on this stuff, and it actually, and this is kind of the scary thought, I did not prompt it to do this. I did not tell you guys this. It asked me, do you want me to try and recreate the image from that night the best way possible, removing all the stuff that I believe they used to retouch the image? I said, sure. And you guys have seen the image that ChatGPT came up with. Now, I'm not saying this is absolutely correct because ChatGPT does make mistakes, but you guys have both seen this. There is still a saucer-shaped object in the middle of those spotlights, albeit it is, granted, much smaller. It is much smaller than what we have in the published photo. But there's still something there, right, Deej?
I believe so. There's absolutely something in the air. They've got all the spotlights trained on it. They're obviously shooting at it. So, you know, the as we'll always wonder, you know, what was it? You know, was it Japanese aircraft? What? You know, and it's fascinating. And again, we go back to technology, you know, that obviously camera technology in 1948. And this is part of the problem with any type of unidentified anything, be it the Loch Ness Monster, Bigfoot, UFOs. The footage is always so grainy. And without an actual original negative, it's going to be too hard to really ascertain what that was. We can speculate until we're all dead.
Sure, sure. Yeah, exactly. I mean, no one knows for sure. Tony, what do you think, man? You've seen the image that ChatGPT produced. What are your thoughts on that?
I've also went and saw the image from the LA Times from 1942. And, like, I don't think there's a big conspiracy on not finding the original plate. I would imagine those would be used because it was the 1940s, guys. They didn't even, and if they weren't reused, they weren't saved. You know what I'm saying? They weren't archiving their plates for everything. This wasn't like, anyway, I don't know. I it's funny. I brought up the governmental conspiracy thing and I almost lean into that more so, because you focus enough spotlights in the sky, you're going to make a circle.
Yeah.
Right. Just to play devil's advocate. And I'm not more than 60, 40, 40, 60, one way or the other. Right. So just trying to play a little devil's advocate here, but it's definitely something. I like the ChatGPT. It's funny. Dave and I, we got him covered. He's the ChatGPT guy. I'm a Grok guy. I'd love to throw this at Grok and see what kind of similarities. I mean, I'm sure they're drawing from the same worldwide interweb pools, you know, but it's interesting. And it's something that makes your mind spin a little bit.
What are the things that I like about the way we're approaching this is we're not approaching this from a 100%, like Tony said, 60, 40, 40, 60, one way or the other. We're leaning into it while still trying to keep it grounded. And I wanted to put that aspect of this conversation over.
No, and we're revisiting these historical things that a lot of people haven't looked at probably. We're using modern tools to kind of look at this whole thing and say, okay, especially in this advent, everybody talks about AI, right? You hear about AI being talked about all the time. We're kind of like, I feel like this sort of project is kind of cutting edge because Tunney's using Grok. I'm using ChatGPT. Sure. But I'm using the most advanced version of ChatGPT that you can pay for. At least I know, I'm paying for it.
Right. And so I'm paying for Grok too, right?
So we're letting AI use this and look at these events, and now we're integrating AI, and people can be anti-AI all they want, but it is a incredibly valuable tool if used in the right way. So I like the fact that we're getting on the ground floor and we're kind of integrating this new technology that is evolving every fucking day to look at these events. And you got an example here with this image. And if anybody hears this and they want the image, I'll be happy to send it to you. DM me. Slide into my DMs. I will send you the image that ChatGPT came up with. You can look at it yourself. The point of this is whatever happened to the negative, and Tunney's probably right. They may have reused the plates. We'll get into something in just a minute, which makes me think maybe not. Maybe they knew something was up. But the spotlights are definitely trained on an object of some sort there. There's something in the middle of this, the size, the shape, however big it is, whatever it is, there's something there. Let's get into the memos that came out because we did talk about, Tony read this. There are some unacknowledged memos from George C. Marshall and from FDR. Now, these are commonly called the Majestic 12 documents. They have been heavily, heavily scrutinized. There's a lot of reason to believe these are not valid, that these are not acknowledged, that they're not even real. But what we can say about this is you can look at, okay, February 27th, 1942. This is just a few days after this incident, like 2 days later. President Roosevelt allegedly references atomic secrets learned from the study of celestial devices and authorizes a Dr. Vannevar Bush to proceed with related projects, whatever the hell that means. Then, about a week later, George Marshall, General Marshall, reportedly states that Army G2 intelligence recovered an unidentified airplane off the California coast with no conventional explanation. The memo suggests that these mystery airplanes were not earthly and in all probability of, quote, interplanetary origin, end quote. That's fascinating if it's true, that redefines history as we know it. There's reason to believe, you know, the font's different. Nothing's been attributed. They've never been able to find it. The article, the document that I put together, the Majestic 12 papers, these documents all surfaced in the 80s. Claiming to reveal a secret government group investigating UFOs called Majestic 12. FBI investigating these documents said completely bogus. Analysis revealed inconsistencies in formatting, terminology, typewriter fonts that are not consistent with the 1940s. So who knows? Who knows about this? But, you know, Tony, I'll go to you first because I know you read the same thing about these documents. They're a fascinating read. The credibility of that, you know, you say 60-40. Probably with these, I'd say, 30-70, with 30% being that they're legit, 70% being that they're non-legit. But what are your thoughts? I mean, could this possibly be true?
They really downplay the legitimacy of these, don't they?
They did, and they probably should, because it sounds insane. Like, if you think about it, how would they have now? I mean, the stuff about Marshall about a week later saying something off the California coast. Okay, now this is all lining up. This could be interstellar. If they down something, or if something went down, okay, I believe that. FDR writing the memo within 2 days talking about something celestial and projects based on that. Well, wait. Where did that fucking come from? But go ahead. I didn't mean to cut you off there.
No. I asked you the question. I wanted to know. It's so hard, though. Like, I mean, we're talking about 80 plus years ago, right? And information relayed then, even in that day and age, like from one day to another, was very much purple monkey dishwasher. And when I say purple monkey dishwasher on any podcast, I am referencing The Simpsons, where they're playing a game of telephone in class, and the statement is something that's not even close to that. It's like Sally went to the store to buy milk. And by after 15 kids, the last kid gets asked by the teacher, okay, what did Jessica start with? And he says, purple monkey dishwasher. Like, we can barely keep news straight today. What makes you think, you know, and on top of the fact that, like, back to the, like, governmental agenda and things of that, like, easily controlled without any skepticism whatsoever, especially back in the 1940s and in a time of a Second World War.
Deej, Tony raises some really good points.
He does. And again, when you go back to control, during a time of war, that is probably, you think, again, going back to 9/11, we probably collectively as a nation had more faith in our government simply because we were united as Americans. Whether we agreed with our government or not, it didn't matter. We were a united country and we were easier to control. And back then it was even worse because of the lapses in information and how information was delivered. The other thing that I would say, and I hate stuff like these documents, especially when you say there's inconsistencies in the fonts and the ink and the method and everything like that, because it really muddies the water of the whole discussion. When I look at these documents, while they are fascinating, there's some verbiage in there that I kind of snicker at, the Majestic 12 and stuff like that. It just seems a little sensationalized, so I'm leaning more to the 70 than the 30 on this. But again, it muddies the actual discussion and it muddies the water of the actual evidence that we have to try and support this. And people that are doing that are making it harder for those of us who want answers to find those answers, because now you have to sift through the rubble.
Yeah. I think we'd all agree that I'm the bigger believer out of the three of us, obviously, but even I'm having some trouble with these documents because they just seem like a little too convenient, right? You know, a little too convenient to try and tie this whole thing together. But at the same time, there's a
part
lot
of you goes, part of you goes, well, maybe though, like if it does tie it all together, then it may be.
It's
but that's very small, right?
We want it to, because we want answers. So we're going to grasp at every little nugget that's out there. And again, try to sift through the rubble and piece this all together.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, sure. The long and short of this is that I firmly believe, 90% sure, there's something in the sky that night. I really think there's something in the sky that night that they fired on and they hit nothing. And that really limits your explanations, doesn't it? I mean, if that's the case, if you see something and the biggest thing is there's a radar. They hit something on radar at 2 o'clock in the morning coming from the coast. What the fuck is that? There's something giving a radar return. I don't think it's a weather balloon. Could it have been an enemy plane? Sure. Could it have been something? I don't know. Something solid. Turning to the big question of if this is a UFO and kind of going along with the whole premise of unidentified history and trying to look at these events and seeing if they give us some clues about today. if it's a UFO, why now? Because this is 1942. We are 3 years before they actually detonate the first atomic bomb. And on the next episode of Unidentified History, we're going to delve into one of the more controversial cases stemming from the detonation of the first bomb. But we're talking 1942, so this is 3 years before they actually explode the first atom bomb. But it is 4 years after they split the uranium atom and discover nuclear fusion. Okay. Now, my theory is once they split that atom, it was like ringing the bell to the universe saying, here we are, guys. Here we are. Is that a valid reason? You know, you look at the increase in UFO activity from 1942 on. There's a sharp increase in this stuff. And you start wondering about, okay, well, what would have attracted them? Splitting the uranium atom and developing nuclear fusion. And then 4 years later, the world is at war. The risk of things getting out of hand and drastically increases. DJ, I'll go to you first. Do you think that might be the reason why, if this is a UFO, why it showed up over one of the major metropolitan cities in the United States at this point in time?
Absolutely. I think the splitting of the atom and the creation of nuclear energy and nuclear weapons brought it. It rang the bell. It said, okay, we have now evolved into a severe warfaring species, and we have now developed the capability of wiping ourselves off our own planet. So yeah, that's a bell you ring. And if we're being observed, they're obviously let's take, what do we do when animals go on the endangered list? We take extra precautions to protect those animals. You know, we put them on lists. We impose fines for hunting, and we take precautions. We go on high alert to monitor those high risk animals. Why are we any different if they're observing us?
Tony, before I turn it over to you, let me pose a question to you and then have you answer that. And then we'll be just about done on this. If it was a UFO, and they were like we've been saying, that the splitting of the array, and don't get me wrong, you nerds out there, history nerds, science nerds will tell me that the atom had been split before. You're right, but not the uranium atom. That was where nuclear fusion was developed in 1938. If that was the ringing of the bell, could this UFO have shown up as a way to test our offensive warfare and capabilities, to see where we were, to see if, can these guys actually do enough damage to us? Let's see how strong they are. And okay, they're not that strong, and off it goes. Is that a possibility, do you think?
I mean, of course. Otherwise, why are we doing this?
Well, I'm just asking, you know what I mean.
Yeah, I mean, it's really hard to like put your thumb on anything, considering it's almost like religion. You don't know what you're dealing with. So how can you like, I equate it to humans and animals, right? Like we have an understanding, they don't, and they'll never get why, they just accept it. And like, there's maybe an understanding of life above us where we're just not on that plane, you know, and that just kind of resurfaces and comes back again and again and again, just because you talk about technology, we have no idea what the fuck it is, right? So it makes you feel inferior.
Yeah. You guys are right. It's an interesting event. It is fascinating to start there, because this is a few years before shit really gets serious with nuclear bombs and, well, not nuclear, atom bombs and things like that. So this thing showing up at this point, and just the mystery of this event that still has not, they're no closer to figuring it out now than we were 60, 70 years ago, or whatever the hell it is. DJ, I'll turn it to you. Final thoughts on the Battle of Los Angeles.
If nothing else, it is a very fascinating moment in United States, if not global history. And I recommend, again, you can reach out to Dave. He has the link to the video. He sent it to us. Fascinating watch if you're into this stuff at all.
Yeah, and there's lots of good documentaries about this, but the 10-minute one I sent you guys is just an easy...
It's easy to digest.
It is, and it will get you thinking. If you haven't thought about this event before, it will get you thinking. Tony, your final thoughts on the Battle of Los Angeles, our first historical deep dive of the show so far.
I mean, it's a brilliant starting point, especially like the route I feel like you're about to take, and which is excellent, because I think we've all kind of picked our angle a little bit. I'm interested to see, like, you know, the evolution of the American public alongside of what's going on as far as UAPs and things of that nature and reporting and the honesty and et cetera, et cetera. So
yeah, it gets fascinating. The, like you're saying, the, the people reporting it, what they're seeing, their reaction to that, you know, I mean, we're still a little ways away from Roswell. And that's where things really change. But starting here, it's like, okay, this is the first kind of event. You can see kind of the mystery surrounding this, not a blatant, nothing happened. We're just like, I don't know what the hell it was.
I firmly do believe, though, if there is captured technology beyond what we have, it is at these forbidden facilities, and it's being tried to be understood, used in its form, and replicated.
And exploited. I'll go so far as to say it's being exploited. If they've got it, if Lockheed developed the Tic Tac, they got that technology from one of these crafts. They reverse it. They didn't come up with this shit on their own. They had some starting point.
How big is the case for all the Tic Tacs? And do they just pop it open on one side on the top and they all come out? And did they smell minty fresh?
You're thinking of a different Tic Tac.
I'm done.
All right. Yeah.
I'm done.
On the next installment of Unidentified History, we are going to look at, quite honestly, one of the most controversial events in ufology, and that is the Trinity case. Trinity took place, you know, and it didn't even really come to light till 2003 when people came forward and started talking. I think it's 2003, but it's one of the most controversial cases there is because a lot of people think it's all bullshit and a hoax. But Jacques Vallée wrote a whole damn book about it. And if you don't know who Jacques Vallée is, he's one of the most respected UFO researchers ever, has written numerous books. He's a scientist who they fashioned the scientist after Close Encounters of the Third Kind. He adamantly says this is a real event. And it happens right within weeks of the testing of the first atomic bomb. You want to talk about ringing the bell. If the splitting of the atom was kind of like a ringing a bell, that's like Tunny hitting the bell a few times. This was just fucking broadcasting it to the universe. That's right.
Universal gong show
when we actually detonated the first atomic bomb. So we're going to cover Trinity on the next episode. It is a fascinating event. I will do my best to get you guys some information on that so you can check it out. But it is really a unique event in the history of ufology. And I think that is as good a place as any for our second historic incursion. Before we cut out of here on Unidentified History this week, let me go around the room. Let's get some information from you guys. Where can people check you out on social media? PC Tunney, lead the way, my friend.
Follow me at PC Tunney on all social media platforms. If you really want to get a hold of me, X would be the place to go. ChairShot Radio Network on all your favorite streaming platforms and ProWrestlingTees.com/TheChairShot. And one of my favorite podcasts, the Mindless Wrestling Podcast, every Saturday morning on ChairShot Radio Network.
Yeah, Deej, where can people check you out since Tunney just outed you?
One third of the Mindless Wrestling Podcast, where we talk all things pro wrestling and WWE. You can find me on the app formerly known as Twitter at the Mindless Pod.
And as for me, if you guys want to check me out, you can follow me on X and Blue Sky at Attitude Ag. That is at Attitude AGG, Facebook.com/Attitude of Aggression and at Attitude of Aggression, all one word, on Instagram and Threads. Guys, thank you so much for being a part of Unidentified History. An excellent episode. I do like the fact that we've kind of like, I'm the true believer, DJ somewhere in the middle. Tunney is all about government conspiracies, and I love it. It's a good thing. No, I thought we all had very interesting perspectives on this first event. It's a fascinating one. On the next time we get together for Unidentified History, we'll see what else. There's a new story breaks loose every week in ufology right now. It is white hot with all sorts of stuff happening. We'll see what happens in the next few weeks. Next episode, we touch on Trinity. Until then, you guys keep your eyes on the skies. I guess keep your eyes on the water as well, as we talked about earlier. And we will catch you guys next time on another edition of Unidentified History.
Breaking news coming in from Bet365, and it's no surprise. Same game parlay from Bet365 just keeps getting better.
Well, it's even easier to make a bet. Choose from the most popular markets like hits, run line, totals, and home runs. So many to choose from.
Download the app, start building your bet, and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.